Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Thank you, and welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call, today in conversation with Lee Mall. Here's how the call is going to work. In a few minutes, our moderator, Sirju Pandya, will engage in a deep dialogue with Acharya Mall, and at the top of the hour, we'll roll into Q&A and the circle of sharing. This week's theme, as I shared earlier, is waking up rather than filling time behind prison walls. I really sort of translate this as the idea of using any of the adversity and difficulty that comes up in our life as fuel for our own personal transformation, which we can then ultimately use for some sort of greater transformation. And Acharya Mall, I think, really has had a remarkable journey in that realm. Since we have the pleasure of having Birju moderating today, I'm excited to hear the conversation between you and Acharya Mall. Would you like to introduce him, Birju?
Yes, I would. I'm so grateful today. Our Awaken Call guest is Fleet Mall. He's the founder and chair of the Prison Mindfulness Institute and the National Prison Hospice Association. So these are examples of hundreds of chapters of each respective organization that exists all over the world. And their work, from what I've seen, has transformed the lives of tens of thousands of people, both incarcerated and not incarcerated. He's been a meditation teacher for over 30 years, and he has a background that's included his own time in prison for nearly 15 years. And he's done so much beyond that particular realm as well. So, Fleet, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Birju. A pleasure to be here.
And just for our collective edification, would you prefer Fleet or Acharya Mall on this call?
Fleet's fine.
Okay, great. And may I ask how you're doing?
I'm doing great. It's a beautiful day here in Western Massachusetts in the Pioneer Valley where I'm living now, and just looking forward to spending this time with you and your audience today, so I'm doing great.
Wonderful. I'd love to start with a little bit more on the background side and maybe have you share a little bit of your roots, where you've mentioned that your experience in mindfulness goes back pretty far, and I'm curious where this interest in mindfulness and compassion first arose.
Yeah, well, I grew up in the Midwest and a Roman Catholic family, and I was always had a spiritual inclination, I think, even as a very young child. I grew disaffected and pretty alienated, really, from the 1950s, early 1960s culture I was growing up in. And although I appreciated the ritual of the pre-Vatican II Catholic tradition, I never really bought into the theology. Exactly. So, you know, I was always looking for something different. Fortunately, the modern Catholic Church has improved the theology greatly, but unfortunately, I think they got away from a little of the beauty of their more mystical ritual. But at any rate, you know, I guess when I was in junior high and high school, I really was reading voraciously in different traditions. And I was actually in a comparative religion class in high school, a Jesuit high school, where I first read some Buddhist scriptures. And they were the first thing that really just made sense to me, the clarity of that. Shortly thereafter, I read a book called Zen and the Art of Archery by a German named Herigel, I think his name is, who went to Japan probably in the 40s or 50s and studied Kudo, the Zen art of archery, with a Kudo master. And it was kind of a direct confrontation or deconstruction of his ego in the process of studying that art with the master. And in that, I just really recognized at that point, I knew I was a Buddhist. And but I was in Missouri at that time, not a hotbed for meditation and Buddhism. This was in the late 1960s. So I started searching everywhere, but eventually I became even more disaffected, and it had been gone headlong into the counterculture of the times and the experimental drug use and even abuse, and at one point decided to leave the country, really looking for something real. And it was during my early travels in Central America and Latin America that I began encountering other travelers, other seekers, and reading more books, and really got interested in meditation. And then actually first started practicing meditation on my own in a very remote valley high in the Andes Mountains in Peru, working with some books like, there was a Taoist book called The Secret of the Golden Flower, which Carl Jung wrote a foreword for. And then I started really focusing in on some of the early translations of the Tibetan Buddhist teachings. But so that's kind of where it began back in the early 1970s. I was later able to, when I found out about the founding of Naropa University in 1974 by the Tibetan master Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, I read about that in South America, decided I needed to go there. And that's where I was really formally introduced into training in mindfulness, both as a practitioner and eventually as a teacher.
My goodness, your answer is just so information packed. We'll be having a recording of this call later, so those who have like been following along, you'll be able to get all the book names and the locations. This is fascinating and also eclectic. So it seems to me that you had this multi-year long process of being acclimated to a wide variety of meditation techniques, schools of thinking around this, very early on in your life. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair to say. I was really looking at everything. I was very interested in the Gurdjieff work. At one point, almost got involved with a Gurdjieff group, but it didn't quite click for me, although I'm still a great lover of his teaching. I was exploring a lot of things, was very interested in Zen. But at some point, I really focused in on the Tibetan Buddhist teachings, and there wasn't much available then. There was basically the Evans-Wentz series. There were four or five books that have been translated, which, you know, today there's hundreds and hundreds. And they're not considered the best translations in the world today, but it's what was available then. And I really had somehow, I don't know whether it was a karmic connection or whatever, but I clearly recognized that was my tradition. And in particular, the experience and the lineage of the great yogi Milarepa. And then when I first heard about Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche and the founding of Naropa University, I mean, that just grabbed me. I just knew I had to go there. I saw his name. I knew I had to go there. He was actually that first summer session at Naropa co-teaching with Ram Dass, and Ram Dass is a great hero of mine today. But at that point, I was really just pulled in by Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, and I didn't really even know at that time that he was actually not only a Tibetan Buddhist master, but of the very lineage of Milarepa. So yeah, I was all over the place. But when I did find that tradition that was, whatever, the right karmic connection for me, there was no question about it.
So I'm curious about the strands of life. I hear you narrating through, the mid-70s. And here we know that just a few short years later, you were sentenced to multiple decades in prison. So what was the life path on both sides that allowed for that kind of expansion in two directions to happen?
Yeah, as I said, I had jumped headlong into the counterculture of the time in the latter part of the 60s and the early part of the 70s, which included a lot of drug experimentation and a lot of drug abuse, all the psychedelic drugs and so forth. But then I shifted into IV drug use and became pretty seriously involved in drug abuse. And actually, my original decision to start traveling in Latin America was in part to escape that world. And my travels throughout Latin America weren't just focused. The primary purpose was not drugs, but rather I realized I was always looking for something real. There was some point early in my childhood, perhaps when school started, that things shifted from being kind of vivid and real and magical to just kind of gray tones, and like the magic was gone. And that may be a normal developmental passage, but I was never able to make peace with it. And so I was constantly looking for something that felt real, something genuine. And of course, the early experiences with alcohol and sex and drugs, these things, kind of feel like, wow, you're plugging back in. It feels real. And they are to some extent, but they also carry with them a lot of baggage, especially if one has a propensity towards addiction. And so, so that was that mixed up journey. And it continued as I was living outside the country as an expatriate, justifying being involved in small time drug smuggling as a way to live outside the system, and having, got into this very polarized us versus them thinking that the system was completely bad, and having a sense of being right and standing outside of it, and justifying all kinds of things. But I was always at the same time a seeker all the way through. And I got to Naropa University, got a master's degree in contemplative psychology, got very involved with Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche and studying, but I kept this secret life going where I was continuing to finance my life and keep my problems at bay. I had a young marriage and a young son, and the marriage was in trouble. And I kept all those problems at bay by continuing this small-time smuggling. And I knew it had to stop. The cognitive dissonance was very loud in my head. And, of course, I self-medicated around that. I would spend about half the year in retreats and training and doing really good things, and another half the year being this crazy cocaine smuggler, cowboy kind of person. It was completely crazy. I knew it had to stop. And by the time I was able to before I was able to pull it apart, I ended up with a federal sentence for drug trafficking.
And so most folks that I would imagine, that's a tough hit. I mean, if I recall correctly, you were sentenced originally to 30 years in prison. And on one side, there's the psychological hit that one must take when one is in their early 30s and being told this. I'm curious how you get from this place of saying, okay, well, this is time I have to do, to this perspective that I'm not going to throw my life away despite this situation.
Well, the first perspective was, as I was standing there getting sentenced, my knees literally buckled and my lawyer kind of held me up. I was actually facing, I was sentenced on the so-called kingpin statute, which I still to this day don't really think was warranted. Not that I didn't earn my way into getting into prison. But at any rate, I could have been sentenced at that time anywhere from 10 to life. I was hoping for 15 or 20. And when I heard 30, my knees literally buckled. When I went back, then I was taken back to this county jail and where I was being held and waiting transfer to a federal prison and so forth. And that's really when the reality of what I'd done to myself, what I'd done to my son in particular, how I'd let down my family, my community, my spiritual teacher, it just hit me, just a ton of bricks. I just hit a brick wall and really went into a dark night of the soul experience of just devastated and really in particular over what I'd done to my son, who was 9 years old at the time. I was literally devastated and finally had to face the truth of the incredible series of selfish decisions I'd been making for years, justifying it in all kinds of ways, thinking I was basically a good person, thinking I loved my son, all of which on some level was true, but it certainly wasn't playing out in my actions. And so I had to face that. And so that's really what began to transform things for me. And I became radically dedicated to extricate all the negativity out of my life and do something positive with this experience. I was scared to death. I was in this county jail hearing all the horror stories about prison, unable to sleep, having nightmares all night long about prison rapes and just all the fears one might imagine having, anticipating going to a high security prison for 30 years. So I was devastated, but I knew that I finally, it was sort of like that moment when I was finally cornered, right? And I knew I had to take everything I'd received and apply it just in a sense of surviving. And I just started focusing on meditation and practicing as much as I possibly could, and really wanting to find some way to leave a better legacy for my son. I had no sense that I would even survive my prison time. And once I got there, I had even less surety that I would survive my prison time. But I wanted to leave my son some better legacy than just his dad went to prison, or even that his dad died in prison.
Mm. So you had this shift in thinking that led to being able to rely a bit more on your past experience, being exposed to all these forms of contemplative practice. And I'm curious how that moves from a sense of personal practice and wanting to maintain personal sanity through this time to saying, okay, I want to do this. I want to offer this to other people. How did that manifest? Did you have immediate uptake when you're telling other people in prison, hey, do you want to meditate? Like, what does that look like?
Well, that worked in a number of ways. To begin with, it was choiceless. I mean, my root teacher, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, it was as if he was sitting right there on my shoulder. And he was an incredible man who, as far as I could tell, and I ended up actually being one of his primary personal attendants and traveled with him extensively, even though I had this secret life going on in the background. And, I'm from Missouri, the show me state, so I'm skeptical by nature, and I was always kind of watching him like a hawk. And as far as I could tell, 24/7, he was dedicated to nothing but the service of humanity and awakening human beings where they were able and willing. And so he was completely service-oriented. So I had that example, and there was no question that I was going to figure out some way to show up and serve and contribute in this world in which I found myself. In order to practice, you start off in prison, at least in a lot of prisons, in these big dormitories. In fact, some you stay in dormitories. But in this particular place, you started off in these 28-man dorms on an upper bunk, and it was just bedlam, especially in the evenings, just a crazy environment. But I would sit up on the top bunk and try to practice late at night. But then I discovered another alternative, especially because I wanted to do extensive practice during the day and on weekends. At the entrance to these dormitories, there was like a broom closet. And in there were the trash cans and the brooms and the mops and everything. So I would go in there and clean it up. It was usually not too clean. I'd clean it up, set the stuff outside so people had access to it, take a folding chair and sit in there and do my practice. And even through the summer months when it was just sweltering and I just sit in there and sweat, it was like sitting in a sauna. But I began doing that, and people saw me doing that. And there was a little window in the door, and sometimes they'd look in and they'd think I was, what's that crazy person doing? Or sometimes without thinking, they'd just open the door and see me in there. But people saw me doing it. And in prison, interestingly enough, even if people don't understand what you're doing, if they recognize you're really disciplined and dedicated to it, they tend to respect it. Also, I almost immediately got a meditation group going in the prison chapel. It wasn't easy because when I first went down there and inquired, they said, no way, prisoners don't start nothing around here. We got a long list of Christian churches that want to get in here and start groups and forget about it. But I found a way to just keep showing up down there, and I found there was a space that was open. And, I said, well, can I just sit here? And they kind of looked at me like they couldn't figure out a reason to say no. So they said, yes, but if anybody comes, you'll have to leave, So anyway, I just started regularly going down. I got a few more guys to join me. And then I got the outer Shambhala community to name us as a Dharma study group. And the chapel started getting mail for this MCFP, which was Medical Center for Federal Prisoners, Dharma study group. And so we just kind of morphed into becoming an official group. So I was doing that. And the way men would just see things about my life, or they see me practicing up in that broom closet or up on my top bunk, and they'd kind of get curious, like, what are you doing, And so I said, well, come down and check it out. And so that's one way that the meditation group attracted people. And, over the years, it was a very transitional place because, there was 1,000 medical patients, 600 medical, 400 psychiatric, and about 300 what they call general population or work cadre inmates like myself. And we were just there to help run the place. We worked in food service. I taught school for 14 years. That was my day job, GED and college and helping people learn to read. People worked in carpentry and welding and, orderlies and in the hospital and in the kitchen and so forth. So I would put out posters a little bit sometimes. I worked in the education department, so I had the possibility of making posters and going and putting them around the institution. But mostly it was people I met, and they became attracted to going there. But there was a lot of turnover at this institution. So the group, we'd have 5 guys, we'd have 10 guys, we'd have 5 guys, it'd get down to 2. Over the 14 years, a couple times I was the only one that showed up. I think that only happened twice. But there was a lot of turnover, but it was people would see something about me and go, in the way I was carrying myself in the prison, and they'd get interested.
So I have to believe, correct me if I'm wrong, the practice in the group, it's not just about sitting in silence together. You know, at some point it goes from silent practice to some form of reflection or sharing with one another. And my guess is that there's folks that have a lot of pain inside, and I'm curious how you would be holding space for so many people who come from holding so much pain.
Well, you know, that's interesting. The way I did that group, and initially we started meeting on Saturdays, then eventually we also had a Wednesday evening. So we had actually 3 hours on Saturday morning and 2 hours on Wednesday evening. And, you know, it was always a newcomers group because there were new people coming all the time. So I would give basic meditation instruction, and we would practice. I managed through the chapel to get them to purchase videos for us. So we had a lot of good videos, a few from the Zen tradition, quite a few from videos that Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein had made from the Insight Meditation tradition. We had a few things from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. So I would sometimes show one of these videos, and we'd have a discussion about it. We'd talk about the practice. In that group, and maybe it was because it was kind of a peer-led group with me primarily leading it, we didn't get into a whole lot of processing of people's pain or what they were dealing with. We really did focus on the practice. Now, today, what I know about from the work we do about your typical prison meditation group, and there are hundreds and hundreds of these groups all over the country, the typical structure is you do some practice, you have some open dialogue, and you do some kind of conscious movement, some yoga, some stretching, some qigong, something like that. And in the dialogue process part, people do surface a lot of the struggle and turmoil that they're dealing with. And this may be because there's kind of often an outside voice there, an outside facilitator to listen. And when I go into groups today, that is often what's coming up. But in the group that I kind of led and facilitated all those years, there was a little bit of that, but it mostly focused on learning the practice and watching videos to get more teachings about the practice. And talking about the meditation instruction itself.
Mm. And so you've alluded to the growth of this work over time, and so I'm curious, as you practiced for the course of years in your own prison term, did you find that this work was expanding beyond your prison, or did that happen later?
Yeah, I actually started receiving letters from Buddhist groups around the country. I had done some writing and been published about my prison experience of being a practitioner in prison in like the Shambhala Sun magazine, a couple other magazines, Tikkun, later in Tricycle and so forth. And so people kind of knew about me out in the Western Buddhist world a bit. And they were starting to get more and more letters from prisoners. And there hadn't been much organized Buddhist prison ministry of any kind in the country. So people really didn't know what to do with these letters. And they started sending them to me in prison. And so I couldn't legally correspond with prisoners in other federal prisons. But I could correspond with prisoners in other state and county prisons. They really didn't like it, but it was kind of a gray area. So I would take these letters. And since I worked in the education department, I had access to a copy machine. I would copy an article from one of the meditation magazines and put a note in there, and I'd send it to this prisoner. And in the doing so, I would kind of be in this state of bliss because I knew how meaningful it was going to be for that person. I mean, when you go to mail callers and you're happy to get junk mail, I really knew the impact it would have on guys. And I was familiar with that Joseph Campbell expression, follow your bliss, right? So I said, this is what I'm supposed to be doing with my life, stuffing envelopes. But at some point I realized this was there was a much greater need than what I could do for my prison cell. And one of the guys who was coming to the meditation group had a contact on the outside that his brother knew or something, and she offered to get involved. And so she ended up being kind of like a mail drop for me. I figured out how to start a 501c3 nonprofit organization. I managed to raise a couple $1,000s from family and friends, and doing all the paperwork and everything, just using her to do the mail for me. got this organization started, and we started off sending books to prisoners and corresponding with prisoners and connecting prisoners with correspondent meditation instructors, and it just started growing. She burned out in about 3 years, and a friend of mine who was then vice president of Shambhala Publications took it on and ran it out of Boston for about the last 10 years of my prison time. And so that's how it started. And, you know, by the time it was called Prison Dharma Network then, and by the time I got out of prison in 1999, it was a really well-established organization. But then we started taking it to an entirely new level once I got out.
So I'm following along, and I'm curious. Actually, let me turn it over, Rahul. I think you have some thoughts or questions on some of the difficulties that may have arose.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, just wanted to apologize for folks on the call who are having trouble hearing me. I sort of had the option of being in an environment where I knew my signal would be muffled or where there would be a baby crying in the background. So. Chose the former rather than the latter. So I was sort of curious about the kind of adversity that may have arose from other prisoners. You know, was there ever any kind of violence or resistance from inmates that really challenged the practice or the group itself? And so how did you deal with that?
Well, you know, as I said, in general, if you're serious about something in prison, and you kind of have your act together, you're not hanging out and get involved in the, you know, the crazy games and the drugs and the sex and the gambling and so forth. You stay away from all that and you're a disciplined person, you avoid a lot of the problems in prison. It really depends on how you carry yourself. You don't want to carry yourself weakly or timidly. You'll attract predators. If you carry yourself belligerently, you better be ready to fight. But you find that way to carry yourself. And so I think there was a general respect. The problems, you know, and that I was also helped start the first hospice program in a prison anywhere. I happened to be doing my time at the U.S. Medical Center for Federal Prisoners, which was the maximum security federal prison. And they brought medical patients from the federal penitentiaries there, the highest security federal prisons. And this was the height of the AIDS epidemic, so we were dealing with all that. And so with another inmate and the support of a prison chaplain and a prison psychologist, started the first hospice program in a prison anywhere, and then later went on to start National Prison Hospice Association to get that movement out into the world. Today, there's over 80 state and federal prison hospice programs in the country. It's one of the things that really helps me sleep at night, that I feel good about something I've done with my life. But at any rate, there was a lot more conflict around that, because there were inmates working as hospital orderlies that would really prey on the patients, steal their food, steal their tennis shoes, steal their belongings, especially when they were dying. So as a hospice volunteer, you often found yourself protecting your patient. And I often got into conflicts there. And you could just get into conflicts anywhere in the prison. I mean, I lived on a unit designed for 50 people that had 120 men on it and no air conditioning in the summer. So there was a conflict or a fight or a dangerous violent encounter waiting around every corner, every time of day. So, you know, really with mindfulness and awareness, I probably avoided thousands of encounters. I did get into five or six potentially really dangerous encounters, and fortunately I managed to handle them without hurting anybody else or getting myself hurt. But, you know, sometimes you really had to step up and challenge the situation. So, it was more around that hospice work that I found myself getting even more potentially conflictual situations. And there were a couple other times, you know, people that are in for sexual offenses often are preyed upon in both state and federal institutions. The state penitentiaries are the worst. But there was a guy coming to our meditation group for a while. There was another guy that was also a teacher in the education department for a while, both who were in for sexual offenses having to do with minors. And that word got out in the prison, and they started getting threatened and people doing stuff. And in both cases, I stood up for them. And that was really a no-no in the convict world, you know. I took a lot of threats to do that. So it came up more around those kind of things than around the meditation group. The meditation group was you know, fairly well accepted. Where people, whether they accepted or respected or thought it was goofy, they knew I was serious about it. And pretty much respected it. One interesting side note was after when I was doing, this is early on when I was practicing in those broom closets. Later on, I eventually got a single cell, managed to keep that for the last 10 years I was in. I could have lost it at any time, even if on an inspection they found a little dust in my corner, but I managed to, it's kind of military style. I managed to keep that for 10 years, and it was a godsend in terms of my practice and study, even though absolute bedlam was just on the other side of the door most of the time. But at any rate, when I was in those early days, when I was still practicing in the broom closets, the black Muslims who want a place to do their prayer six times a day, seeing that, they started really, well, they could do that too. So then there started to be a little competition for use of the broom closet sometime. And we managed to work through that.
Very interesting. You know, there are actually a number of people right now listening from jails, and we have a question from someone in the Boulder County Jail who says, I have a serious anger issue. I was wondering if you have any special techniques to overcome this.
Yeah, anger is really one of the most difficult things to work with. I think to begin with, it's really helpful to, just step by step to begin to develop a little mastery of our own physiology, using simple breathing techniques to when we start to get triggered into that fight or flight response, which often is fueled with anger, and underlying the anger, of course, is fear. That we use simple breathing techniques, focus on belly breathing, do the straw breathing, which is where we breathe in through the nose and then out through pursed lips as if through a straw. And we're doing that with the breathing with the belly and breathing out a few counts longer than the in-breath. So breathing in maybe a four count, you know, the count is kind of like our heartbeat, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then breathing out maybe a 6 or 7 count like that. That will immediately engage the parasympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system, which is about down-regulating, and shift us out of that fight or flight response. So that can be helpful to de-escalate ourselves when we find ourselves getting angry. The other thing is to begin to really look at the source of the anger. You know, when we get angry, it's basically we want a yes and we're getting a no in some form or another. And, you know, and then some supposed me says, I ain't putting up with that, you know, and I start to get really angry. So, you know, when we're angry, there's always a really strong I in there, like, you can't do that, or I'm not putting up that, or you can't do that to me. And what's really helpful is to just always bring right into the midst of that storyline, who, you know, who's the me, who's the I, who's the they, you know, me, who, you know, and if we're using some meditation practice, regular daily meditation practice, and we begin to really question that fundamental I and me and other that's underlying those stories of anger, we can begin to deconstruct it on the spot a little bit. And actually, when we cut through the storylines that really add fuel to our anger, what we're left with is the clarity, which is a natural, you know, in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, we talk about all the emotional states as having their own inherent wisdom. So anger is connected with the Vajra family, mirror-like wisdom. And when we cut the storyline and the self-identification, which is like which throws the gasoline on the fire, and we're also using some breath work and so forth, then we can defuse that kind of anger, and what we're left with is the clarity and the mirror-like wisdom. So anger is a really interesting one to work with, but one of the most difficult ones to work with.
Thank you for that. I'd love to translate that into like an experience that you've had. So you've mentioned you've mentioned working with folks in the hospice context as well as in the prison system itself who want to engage in contemplative practice. Do you have like a particular example of a person or an experience that you had that really sticks with you, like somebody who's made strides as a result of some of these practices or the spaces to practice?
Well, a couple of short stories come to mind. One is what would very often happen when we were going up to see our patients, and as hospice volunteers, we did very extensive training. We brought outside people in to train us, and I did a lot of the training myself over time, and I managed the training program for about 11 years, and we constantly tried to keep up about 10 prisoners, inmates who were trained to be hospice volunteers. And then we were assigned to particular patients, and we would stay with them throughout their process up to their eventual death, unless they were had the good fortune of being released before they died, either on a, what was called a medical release, or they just finished their time. But in many cases, they ended up dying there. And so very often we'd go up to visit our patient and find that they'd been unattended for hours, that they'd messed themselves, that their bed was full of urine or feces, they were getting bed sores just because of really criminally negligent treatment by the staff and lack of treatment. And, you know, it's a very polarized environment. And I saw even good new nurses when they got hired in, or later they started hiring certified nursing attendants as well. I'd see them coming initially trying to give really good care, and then they start getting all this pressure from the correctional staff and start buying into the correctional culture. And pretty soon they're just hanging out in the guard shack or the nurse's station and just going to see the patients when they absolutely have to. And so we would come up and you'd find this patient who you've been by that time really bonded with. They're like a family member to you. And there they are, and they've been laying in their own urine or feces for 4 hours, you know. And, I mean, it's just the rage comes up. You're just so angry, right? But if you storm down to the nurse and start telling them off, well, you're not going to be a hospice volunteer anymore. You're going to be in the hole. You'll be kicked out of the hospice program, and, you know, your patients will be worse off. So, you know, you really had to find some way to get yourself together, right? So I used all the abilities I had to de-escalate and diffuse that anger. And instead I would focus on just, you know, cleaning up my patient, getting, you know, changing their sheets, getting them all clean, redressing them, getting them all completely comfortable in their bed again. And usually by the time I completed all that work and got them dry and clean and comfortable in a fresh bed, the anger had completely diffused and I was more just connected with them. So that's one example. Another is one of my hospice patients was a man who'd been coming to the Buddhist meditation group for quite some time. It was towards the end of his time there that he revealed to me that he was an AIDS patient. And I was curious because he'd been interested in all the videos we had there in the chapel that were kind of about death and dying. We had some great stuff from Stephen Levine and Ram Dass and other stuff. But he got transferred back to his home institution. Later he got transferred back and he was very ill. I got assigned as a hospice volunteer and I spent the next almost a year with him. And he went through such stuff. This was before the protease inhibitors became available. And AIDS patients suffered from every kind of opportunistic infection and skin malady and just constant suffering and pain. Horrible hemorrhoids and skin maladies and night sweats and constant chills and fevers, and he couldn't go to the bathroom without excruciating pain. But he was a practitioner. And we had this common bond in that we both had sons who were 9 years old. He also had a daughter who I think was 7. And the most, despite all this suffering, the most painful thing for him was the fact of what he'd done to his children and his son and daughter were out there growing up without his father. Well, you can imagine, as I would hold him and he would share all this, it was really hard for me to remain objective because, you know, I had my own experience with my own son who was growing up without his dad. And, you know, that informed my ability to be with him, but I had really developed the capacity to set that aside and just be there for him and really hold him in that. And he was a profound example and teacher for me because, patients are in such a disempowered situation there and they have absolutely no control over their own care, their own medications, their own choices, the food they get, anything. And they often get really angry, and sometimes they direct that anger at the staff. And they get in very conflictual and polarized relations with the staff, get locked up all the time. And, you know, there's a lot of that going on. He never expressed the slightest anger towards the staff. He was always very courteous. And even though he was suffering, he never complained about his suffering. You know, I would pack him in ice. Sometimes I'd just sit there and hold him while he was shivering. And he never complained. The only thing he ever expressed grief and pain about was his kids. And he tried so hard to practice. Even when he came back in this incredibly debilitated situation, you know, he wanted to sit up and practice with me. And I said, you know, he could barely, he was skin and bones. I said, no, just lay there, you're fine. No, I got to sit up. I had a really strong practice while I was at the other place. And so I helped him sit up and we sat there, you know, and I was in the room. He had tuberculosis and he had another thing that kind of masked that. And so where they couldn't determine if the tuberculosis was active or not. And so I had to be in there. He was in a pressure, negative pressure room, and I had to be in there with a mask on. And we're sitting there knee to knee practicing meditation. And those masks, after about 10 minutes, are no good. And so I'm sitting there with him practicing meditation for half hour, and I realize, you know, after 10 minutes, we're sitting there exchanging breath, you know. And I'm going, oh, my God, you know. But I just, you know, hung in there with it because he was hanging in there with it, you know. So he was such an example of bravery and the fruits of practice to me, that he was really one of my teachers. His name was Lyle, and he ended up dying there in the prison.
Wow. Oh, thank you for sharing that. I'm moved at knowing that what you just shared, you have unlimited stories of behind. And I do want to move forward just to keep going and recognizing that, as I understand it, you were released from prison when you were 50. So that was a few decades ago now. And it, from my understanding, the work that you're referring to has just grown in the wildest of ways. As I understand it, you not only have all of these programs to continue working with people who are within prisons and people who are in hospice, but also working with law enforcement, working with the judicial system, working with business leaders. It seems like you're addressing every link in the chain. And I'm curious how this all happened coming out of prison 20 years ago.
Yeah, I'm not sure how it all happened. I knew when I went in. Of course, I thought I was going to be 65 when I got out. I thought it was basically all over. But I was, you know, going to dedicate myself to do something with my life anyway. It took me about 3 years going through and learning how the good time worked under the old law. And after my appeal went through and they knocked off one count, then I realized that if I stayed out of trouble, I would serve 14 years. And at that point, it still felt like forever. But I knew I'd be, you know, close to 50 when I got out and broke and with a record, and it wouldn't be easy to get a life going again. And so, you know, I was dedicated to both preparing myself to be of use when I got out and also really adding value to the community I was in. And you know, that somehow that just really paid off. And one of the things that I think really has served me since from my time in prison is I was in a maximum security facility that is really what sociologists call a total institution, which means it's basically a totalitarian environment. Resistance is futile. And in particular, that place, if you tried to buck the system, you'd be back in a psychiatric ward, naked on a concrete bunk, you know, with restraints and be getting hosed down at night and pumped with Thorazine or Halidol. I mean, it was really serious, no joke. So resistance was futile. And the basic answer to everything is no. Like, could we start that? No. Could we start that? No. Why couldn't we have this program? No. Well, they tried it before, some inmate abused it. You know, they always have their stories. So how do you get anything done in an environment where you have absolutely no power and the answer to everything is no? Well, you have to get really creative, right? And I really benefited from my root teacher, Trogdon Trungpa Rinpoche. His emphasis was never so much on right or wrong, not that he didn't believe in morality, but he focused, as in the Buddhist tradition, on skillful means. What's skillful? What actually are the causes and the conditions that create happiness? What are the causes and conditions that lead to suffering? And how do you skillfully communicate with people to get things done? So I was not in there battling with the staff and, you know, this is right, I'm going to sue you. And, you know, I was just thinking, how do I work with people? And I kind of figured, over time I discovered that people were kind of like vending machines. We have, this is not a wonderful, very humane analogy, but we have all these buttons. Like, you know, you push one button, you get a Coke, another button, you get a Diet Pepsi, another button, you get a water, right? And everybody's got their human being button. I mean, if you go to the staff, you press their authority button, that's what you're going to get. Or if you press their fear button, that's what you're going to get. But you find that human being button somewhere. And over time, you know, you're consistent, you're courteous, you're genuine, you're real. It's amazing how you can get in relationship with people and get things done. And I was able to create a lot of programs in that institution through the educational department, through the chapel, and also start two national organizations while I was there, which is unheard of because, you know, you go up to the staff and say, oh, I want to start a nonprofit. They tell you you're crazy, but I just did it. And it happened, and they knew about it, and they kind of weren't crazy about it, but they, you know, they couldn't quite figure out. But at one point, when they realized how big the whole thing had gotten, an assistant warden called me, and he goes, "Let me get this straight. You know, they want to interview you on NPR, and you have this nonprofit organization out there running. No, wait a minute, you're running two nonprofit organizations, and now you want to do this and you want to do that." He said, "What the hell is going on here?" He was just like, "How did this happen?" You know, he was amazed that he figured they'd been asleep at the wheel for a long time or something. But at any rate, you know, how do you get things done? So, you know, I think I learned a lot. And when I got out, you know, and started right out of prison, started working as a business and management consultant. And I think that's what I really bring to the world as a consultant and executive coach is really an in-my-bone sense of how do you work with people and how do you get things done. You know, also I think, I've just had nothing but opportunities since I've been really grateful to travel around the world, do the Dragon Witness work with the Zen Peacemakers in Auschwitz and in Rwanda, to lead street retreats around the country. I've been very empowered by my own spiritual lineage, the Shambhala community. Today I'm a senior teacher and Acharya in that lineage. Also, Bernie Glassman, my Zen mentor, empowered me as a sensei. So my teachers and communities have been very empowering to me. And the prison work, you know, kind of timing. I mean, for a long time, it felt like we were pushing this big boulder up a very steep hill. And the world of corrections and criminal justice was getting darker and darker. And we knew we were doing good work and changing lives, but it was kind of like lighting candles in the darkness. But eventually, you know, things change, and today the world is kind of awoken to the fact that our criminal justice system is broken and unsustainable. Even really on both sides of the political spectrum, people agree it's broken and unsustainable. So, you know, it's amazing. The world is actually starting to cooperate with us a little bit. It's kind of scary, and the work has just really taken off. We have prisoner programs all over the country and around the world, and there's a lot more research establishing these kind of curriculums as evidence-based practice, which is really one of our main organizational missions. And now we're getting the opportunity to work with correctional officers and law enforcement, first responders, with prosecutors and judges, bringing mindfulness and mindfulness-based emotional intelligence to them in ways that they realize are making their jobs more effective, more sustainable, that are helping them protect their own health and get better results. And things are just taking off in so many different ways.
Wow, that's so beautiful, Fleet. I know that we do have a lot of people listening from jails around the country, and several of them have asked for resources. So we'll be sure and mail out links about sort of practices and how to support meditation in prison from all of your wonderful work.
Here's you, one of our programs at Prison Mindfulness Institute is to send books to prisoners all over the U.S. and around the world. So anybody that's listening in can certainly write to us and let us know whether you're interested in Zen or Tibetan Buddhism or insight meditation or what have you, or just that you'd like to get started with practice, and we're happy to send books out.
Yes, and that's going to be at the Prison Mindfulness Institute. And if Rahul's voice was muffled in any way, the email address again is ask@servicespace.org. And I'd love to just dive in a little bit before we get started on opening up those phone lines, Fleet. You had mentioned at the start of your time in prison, one of the things that really stood out to you was that sense of remorse and regret with the kind of example for your son. And so here you are, you know, so much of life has changed. And I'm just curious, like, on one level, there's all the work that you've done for the world and the benefits that have come out of that. I'm curious about your own ongoing journey and your own ongoing relationships. How has that evolved as a result of this work working on you?
Yeah, well, you know, you got to be careful what you ask for. Once you really dedicate yourself to a life of transformation, a life of spiritual evolution, life will certainly bring you, you know, the opportunities and the challenges. You know, during my time, I stayed in touch with my family, and one of my great longings was, you know, to be with my son again, to be with my mother and father again. And it just worked out that my dad died of cancer shortly before I got out of prison. they did let me go home to his for the funeral, which was amazing. They allowed that. Then my mom died of cancer 5 months after I got out. They died just 10 months apart. So I lost both of them right around getting out of prison. Then the woman who'd been my girlfriend before I went to prison, and amazingly, we remained best friends because I was a terrible boyfriend before I went to prison. But we remained best friends, and we were even toying with the idea of whether to get back together or not when I got out. She was living in Canada, had a great job up there. Her daughter was up there. I couldn't leave Colorado. And but a year after I got out of prison, she came down with a kind of cancer and died very quickly. So I went through all that kind of loss. I'd also lost my spiritual teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche, early on in my prison time in 1987 when he died. So I'd experienced really a lot of loss, a lot of challenges of that kind, and you know, really had to bring everything I'd learned and all my practice and who I was as a human being to bear on how to deal with that, how to be with that. I went through some really, really tough times around those losses. I then, you know, continually working on the relationship with my son. Thank goodness my son's still very much with us. And, you know, we've had a challenging time, as you can imagine. If your father was in prison when you grew up, you'd have some anger issues about that. And he does and has, and we've done a lot of work on it. And fortunately, he's managed to stay out of trouble, and he's doing okay with his life, and we're very, very close. We have our issues at times, and we work through it, but that's a really important relationship to me, and we work on that a lot. And you know, family relationships are tough because, you know, the people closest to you are the people who can push your buttons. And, you know, no matter how many months of time I spent in meditation retreat every year, you know, my son can still push my buttons. So, you know, that's an ongoing challenge. Also, sadly, I, you know, back in about, I don't know, somewhere around 2002, I connected with a woman who was just my absolute soulmate. And I'd known her before I went to prison. She was part of the Shambhala community for a long time. And we had so much in common, and we just really bonded. We were both at a place in our life when we could finally do relationship, and just had an amazing relationship and partnership. And then I lost her to cancer in 2008, after being together for 6 years. So, you know, life is going to bring challenges, and you just have to keep stepping back up to the plate. You know, here I am. I thought maybe that's it for me in the relational sphere. I mean, I just don't know if I can do this anymore. But, you know, I jumped back into the frying pan about almost 2 years ago. I started dating a wonderful woman named Sophie, and we're now living together, and it's fabulous. And so, you know, I've jumped back into that frying pan, and you just have to keep stepping back up to the plate, you know, with courage and bravery and you know, just keep putting one foot in front of the other. And as long as you're continuing to do your practice, you know, as an acharya in the Shambhala tradition, one of the, you know, there's about 30 acharyas worldwide. The Shambhala community is a global community with over 300 centers worldwide. So we have hundreds, maybe several thousand teachers, actually. And the acharyas are the most senior teachers, and the head of our lineage, Sakya Mipham Rinpoche, holds an extremely high bar for us in terms of our ongoing practice and study, and we study with him very personally. So you got to be really, really committed to deep practice on a daily basis and a lot of retreat practice and training throughout the year. So I'm immersed in that. I'm still immersed in my Zen practice and the bearing witness work, and you combine that with what life brings to you. And, you know, that's living in the fire, what Trungpa Rinpoche called living in the challenge. Sometimes people, and I've used the metaphor, a lot of other people use it, of the charnel grounds, which is, you know, in India and Nepal and Tibet, people that couldn't afford a cremation, they would just throw the bodies out in these wild places, and, you know, they'd just be devoured by wild animals. And these places became, you know, kind of mythological places of tremendous fear. And it said even yogis would some go live there to confront their deepest fears around their own mortality and so forth. So this idea of charnel grounds is kind of this metaphor for the scariest places in life. And so a lot of the work I do, going to Rwanda, to Auschwitz, the prison work, going out in the streets, you know, some people reference that as charnel ground work. But we all have a charnel ground going on right between our ears and right in our own hearts. Just a challenge of being alive as a human being with an open heart is no small thing. So if we're doing the work to continually further open our heart and open our heart and open our heart and keep stepping into the challenges of life, that we're living in that charnel ground, living in the fire of transformation. And And you know, it's not an easy journey, but it's such a rewarding journey because you feel the realness of it, right? And you know, it's like that you can stand there and you know, just kind of like, you know, the life almost got me that time, but I'm still here, you know. And you just feel like you're alive and you're surviving and you're leaning into the fear and the pain of it all. And you know, there's something incredibly rich and powerful and meaningful about living your life in that way.
I'd love to push just a little bit on that, because at this point, you know, you're an inspiration to just many, many thousands of people. And as a senior teacher today, I'm curious what it is that is your own edge of growth. You know, where do you find opportunities to continue growing in yourself?
Well, just on a daily basis, you know, being in relationship. I mean, as I said, the people closest to you can most easily push your buttons. So, you know, I practice a lot, like anybody who's been practicing for 40 years and does a lot of deep practice. I've had a lot of powerful meditative experiences, a lot of, you know, realizations and so forth and deep insights. But, you know, it still comes down to living your life every day. And, you know, there's a lot of times when you just distinctly want to tell the world to go away and you want to shut down and just focus on yourself or your own needs. And so, you know, every moment I'm presented with being in relationship with the people in my organization, being in relationship with my son, being in relationship with my girlfriend, I do a lot of teaching and lead a lot of retreats. So, you know, there you're really on the spot. In some ways, that's almost easier for me because it's kind of what I do and I thrive on it and I'm practicing as I do it. So I'm in a practice state and it's a flow and I love that. And the challenge is more in between and in the moments of our life when we're being in relationship with the people intimately in our life, or even just with the people we're dealing with as we're traveling, the people in the stores, the taxi driver, the people at the airline counter, you know, staying in relationship, staying open, being conscious, being mindful, being compassionate, and is a constant challenge. It's just a constant challenge. And I think that's where the growth always is. It's in the midst of our daily life. You know, it's really important to have a really consistent, deep daily practice, and it's really important to do a lot of retreat practice and to do solitary retreat practice when you can. All those things are really challenging. But where the rubber really meets the road for me is in our ongoing daily interactions with the people in our life and the tendency to want to get focused on my own needs rather than other people's needs and the tendency to start to shut down and get armored up and feeling that and instead letting go and reopening. And that, to me, that's where the ongoing edge of transformation is.
And Fleet, we do have a question that came in online. This is from Carol Ruth Silver in San Francisco. She says, I spent a short time in prison and a longer time as a lawyer for the prisoners in the San Francisco County Jail. My focus is now trying to reduce incarceration by reversing the prohibition of drugs throughout the country. As a speaker for law enforcement against prohibition, do you support repealing the war on drugs, legalizing, taxing, and regulating all drugs as a health matter?
Absolutely. I think the drug war is misguided and has been completely ineffective and has been incredibly damaging. Drug addiction is a medical issue. I think drugs should be decriminalized, regulated, and we need to put the resources into treatment for those who are struggling with addiction. Absolutely. Criminalizing it has been completely ineffective and has given us, it's been one of the things that's really fueled this prison industrial complex, which became a self-perpetuating industry, to where we have, you know, over 2.3 million people incarcerated, over 7 million people in the system altogether. Everybody's heard the statistics. We incarcerate 25% of the world's prisoners. It's just really obscene statistics, and in part, it's been, or in large part, it's been driven by this drug war. So I definitely favor decriminalization, and I'm not in any way, shape, or form promoting drug use, but it's a medical issue, and addiction and alcoholism should be treated as a medical issue.
Interesting. You know,
at least in my opinion.
Right. My wife and I recently watched this latest Michael Moore film called Where to Invade Next, which sounds like a play on kind of America's military adventures around the world, but it's actually a film about him
visiting other countries and exploring how they deal with things like crime, you know, the drug war, prisoners. And it was really remarkable to see how these issues are treated differently in Europe, very much along the lines, and drugs are treated very much along the lines of what you're talking about here, Fleet. And what also particularly struck me was the way in which we treat prisoners in the United States very much is in this role of kind of a punitive space where the law enforcement is dehumanizing people. And I think there seems to be much more clarity in Europe that both parties are basically in prison when you do that. I mean, the guards and the prisoners, and there's a dehumanizing effect on all of them. And so it was, you know, despite recognizing this concept, it was sort of a very strange experience to see how well prisoners are treated in Europe, even when they've done the most horrific crime. I'm curious if you can reflect on just the prison, I mean, how prisoners are treated and what is sort of the skillful means in dealing with the situation with regards to how we treat prisoners in the country today.
Yeah, I've seen the Michael Moore film. It's a good film. I would want to be clear that I'm very current on the state of corrections in Europe, and he was referencing the system in Norway, and there certainly are some good examples of a much more enlightened approach to criminal justice and corrections in the Scandinavian countries. That does not apply to all of Europe at all, and even in those Scandinavian countries, in Norway, for example, those kind of prisons that were depicted in the Michael Moore film is where you can go when you're getting closer to finishing your time, but other prisoners are in institutions that are more similar to the ones we have here in the U.S. So, again, I just don't want to over-idealize things, but at the same time, that it is really pointing to some of the solutions. And there are some very different attitudes in some of the countries, especially the Scandinavian countries. Here in the U.S., we have so demonized people who break the law and people who get in trouble. There's shows like Lock Up on MSNBC that are highly exploitative and just, you know, scaring people to death because they go and they show the scariest looking prisoners they can find being as crazy as they can possibly be. And, you know, we so demonized all that. And when you go to prison, I don't care what you get locked up for, you're just immediately buried in shaming and demonization. I had a good friend who was a tenured school teacher in the Denver school system and dedicated community servant for so many years. And she was a grandmother, and they came and arrested her at her house for something to do with her dog and dog being off leash and something about the neighbor's call. Anyway, they come and cuffed her and put her in the back of a squad car and took her down and booked her. You know, and she went through that same shaming experience that any prisoner goes through. And, you know, in prison, for me, one of the really necessary factors to personal transformation is where we really honestly face the harm that we have caused and develop a real genuine sense of regret and remorse around that, which is not guilt and shame. That's very different. Guilt and shame is about how horrible I am. It's very self-focused. Regret and remorse is about the other, that we really see the impact we've had on others, and we wish we could change it, go back and reverse it so it never happened, or somehow heal it or repair it, or at the very least not cause any kind of harm like that again. And it's very difficult for prisoners to get in touch with that because they're so hit with all the shaming and demonization that naturally we're just instinctually trying to protect ourselves, kind of protect our own mind and being. And so what we often protect ourselves with is we armor up with anger and bitterness and our victim stories. And, you know, and most prisoners can, despite how, you know, they may be very guilty, but at the same time, most prisoners are so over-prosecuted and the system, you know, that, you know, even prisoners who have done some, you know, pretty untoward things end up feeling themselves like victims. And of course, most people that do negative things and violent things and have been victimized as children anyway, for the most part. So, you know, it's really easy for prisoners to get stuck in this victim mindset. And really, when you're in the prison, that's the conversation that's going on all day long. It's about victim story, about the man, about the guards, about their lawyers, about the guy that, you know, ratted on them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, it makes it very difficult for prisoners to get into that place where they have the courage to face themselves, face the impact of their own actions and decisions, and get connected with that deep sense of regret, which to me is what really begins to fuel the spiritual journey. You know, for me, what really hit me when I went in was the deep regret I experienced about my son, but I was still justifying my involvement in drugs. You know, cocaine was a recreational drug back in the 70s. Lawyers and doctors and judges were doing it. Da, 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 da. I would have never sold heroin. I was, you know, I had all these self-justifications, but I was in very involved in 12-step work dealing with my own substance abuse problems. And after sitting in those meetings for the first 2 years and listening to one man, this is a male prison, listening to one man tell, like, after another, tell a story about how his life unraveled around cocaine use in particular, I could no longer hold up the artifice of my justifications anymore. And I realized what I've been involved in for a long time was extremely harmful. And I had to face that. And I just developed this profound longing to at least not cause any more harm. So, you know, that's a necessary part of transformation for prisoners. And we actually prevent them from having that experience by the approach we take to incarcerating and demonizing them.
That's very insightful, you know, the distinction between guilt and shame and regret and remorse. Thank you so much, Pleat. We do have a question in the queue from Amit, and I just wanted to remind others that you can press star 6 to get your question in the queue, and we will go to Amit for now. Hold on. Here we go.
Hi there. This is Amit. I'm actually pulled over on the side of the road because I want to ask this question, and I've been enjoying this call, so thank you so much for sharing all that you have so far, Pleat. And my question is that, you know, when you think about the time and the process that you went through when you were in prison, and then also with so many other individuals that you've come across your way, both in and out of prison, I would think that there's so many excuses that can come up for why someone wouldn't move forward in their practice, right? Even for yourself, whether it was overcoming addiction, whether it was, you know, just being in prison, and even though there are powerful motivators, such as, you know, being that example for your son, there's the day-to-day practical realities of your surrounding environment. It's easy to move into this cowering or going into old habits. And I'm curious, what is it that you did and things that you recommend to others to sort of fight through that, to maintain that daily practice, to overcome that sort of even a sense of laziness or distraction that we sometimes end up being prone to mentally?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. And I have a couple of threads on that. One is, anytime we're trying to develop ourselves, to develop a consistent meditation practice, to work out, to lose weight, to take better care of ourselves, to work on building a business, to do anything that takes effort, we're always going to run into resistance. So it's really important to expect the resistance, right? And to make friends with the resistance, because otherwise the resistance catches us off guard. You know, if we make a commitment to practice meditation at 5 p.m. every day, I can guarantee you, at 4:45, you're going to start hearing storylines in your head. Oh, I'm too busy today. I'm not feeling too well. Oh, I have to do that thing. Or, you know, it's just going to happen. And if you buy into those storylines, boom, you don't go practice. But if you recognize, oh, there's the resistance thinking. Thank you very much. It's like my alarm clock. And you let that accompany you right to the meditation cushion. So expecting the resistance and making friends with it, I think, is very important in terms of doing any of this kind of work. I want to mention one other thing, and this is something that came out of my time in prison and a type of work that I'm incredibly grateful that I was introduced to. But all the work I do in the world, we're taking it into business owners or for prisoners or correctional officers or law enforcement, or we take it into hospitals, work with doctors and nurses, all kinds of folks in life. We call our work basically a mindfulness-based emotional intelligence curriculum of one form or another. But within that is embedded this module that I call radical responsibility. And it comes from, at least in part, I've added to it and elaborated on it, but the core of it came from a training called The Event,
that I still lead, and that I was introduced to in prison because the founder of the event got in touch with me, read some of my writings, wanted to use some of my stuff in his curriculum. We got in relationship. I managed to miraculously get him into the prison. We did 4 events while I was there. If the prison knew what it was before it came in, they never would have allowed it. I mean, we do stick work. We do intense, it's very intense personal transformational workshop, kind of old school style, but it creates very powerful transformation. And I'm very grateful I still lead 2 events a year today. And if somebody wants to check it out, it's just theeventtraining.com. But the radical responsibility core that came out of that is, the way I talk about it, is voluntarily embracing 100% radical responsibility or ownership for every circumstance I face in life, day in and day out. And of course, some of the circumstances we face, we can see we had a hand in creating when we're honest enough about it. But there may be stuff that just seems like it fell on our head, you know, came out of nowhere, and everybody would agree I had nothing to do with it, unless it's past life karma. Who knows about that kind of thing, you know? So, and this is not about self-blame, but it's just going, okay, there it is. It's in my lap now. The only salient question, I mean, I can spend some time, you know, having my feelings about it. That's normal. But at some point, the only salient question of what am I going to do? What am I going to do with this? And you know, that's focusing my energy on that which I can do something about, which is myself. But we spend so much of our time blaming external circumstances, blaming even internal circumstances, blaming our past, blaming our childhood, blaming other people, blaming the weather for our own internal states and our own states of motivation or lack of motivation. And, you know, it's just a waste of time because none of that do we have any control over whatsoever. It's hard enough even to influence our own behaviors, but at least we have a shot there. So my focus is this idea of radical responsibility to voluntarily embrace 100% ownership. And that's a constant transformational edge for myself, day in and day out, to keep stepping up to the plate to see. And I experientially deliver these trainings, and in the midst of it, I help people discover this what I call life distinction, that circumstances are neutral. Now, of course, some circumstances feel a lot less neutral than others. Some are criminal, some are horrible, some are just heartbreaking. We wish they would never happen to any human being. But at some point, once something's happened, the only place where we can move forward in our lives is to focus, what am I going to do with this? And maybe I just need to go get a lot of healing and a lot of support. But still, at some point, there's a choice, what am I going to do with this? Otherwise, we move into that kind of victim mind thinking where I'm helpless and the cause of my internal state is out there and I'm powerless to do anything about it. Now, it's completely reasonable that we fall into that as human beings, and horrible things happen to human people. I'm not in any way not validating that. But nonetheless, you know, where we can put our energy to empower ourselves to move forward with our practice, with our life, is really, for me, this idea of radical ownership or radical responsibility, where we just don't, we waste as little time as we can in blame and resentment and being caught up in being right, and instead just focus, what's the most creative response to what I'm facing right now?
Thank you. We've got a couple of questions that came in online. I think 2 of these are from Carol Ruth Silver, again, in San Francisco, and I'll ask one after the other. The first is, have you had any suggestions as to how to begin to de-radicalize Islamist young men in prisons in America and Europe? And I'll let you respond to that before I ask the next question.
Yeah, boy, I don't know. That's a big one. It's not an area where I've done any work, so I'm really hesitant to say much. The only thing I could say is that it would have to start with empathy. You know, demonizing people and making them wrong, it doesn't help. I mean, you know, I don't want to connect it to it in any way, shape, or form, but Marshall Rosenberg, who was a great teacher to me, his work in nonviolent communication, he often used the example of sex offenders, and I'm not in any way connecting that with the radical Islamic thing, but I'm just using it as a point that he said, how do we relate with them? Well, we just shower them with fear and demonization and shame, right? And that actually just feeds their cycle of playing out their own addictions of shame. And what we have to be able to get into an empathic space with them where we realize that they're trying to get their needs met in the most beautiful way they can. Now, when he says that in relation to sexual offenders, the audience goes crazy. Well, if he said that in relation to somebody who's involved in terrorism, the audience would go crazy too. But we have to be able to listen to them and realize that their actions are coming out of their own pain, their own suffering, and they're trying to meet their needs in some way or another. We're all trying to meet the same needs, to be happy, safe, and secure, all human beings. Unfortunately, we get our psychology twisted up and we do some pretty terrible things in that effort to meet our needs. But so I think it has to start with listening and with empathy, because you got to create relationship. If there's got to be any dialogue about helping invite someone into different strategies to get their needs met, then it's got to happen within a ground of empathy where they feel listened to and feel respected. So I think that's where we have to begin.
Wonderful. And then the other question was, have you found any positive impact from the recent restorative justice movement in prisons and jails within the United States?
Oh, absolutely. I just wish it could expand further. I mean, we consider ourselves very much part of the restorative justice movement. I've given a lot of talks on, been to a lot of restorative justice conferences. Prison Mindfulness Institute, Engage Mindfulness Institute, we very much feel we're part of the restorative and transformative justice movement. And it is definitely the right answer to when there is criminal activity or human tragedy. Instead of using retributive justice or punishment-oriented justice, what we really need to focus is on harm reduction and how to repair harm that's had, how to repair the break in the community fabric. And what I like about transformational or transformative justice is it goes a step further than restorative. I mean, restorative justice, some programs certainly are transformative in nature, but what the transformative justice word means, and you find more use of that in New Zealand, Australia, and in Canada, is that it's very preventative. In other words, we're looking not just how to respond to a crime once it's happened, but looking at the causes and conditions out of which the crime arose. So what in that individual's life who's doing some kind of harmful behavior, what has happened in their life? What do we need to do to listen to them and bring them healing if we actually hope that they're going to start behaving differently? And then what are the societal causes and conditions that are creating that experience for them and many others? If we're not willing to look at how do we change those societal conditions, we can't hope to prevent more crime. But even if you were just starting with the crime and responding to it with a healing restorative paradigm rather than a punish retributive paradigm, you're going to get much better results. So, yes, I'm a big believer in both restorative and transformative justice movements and feel part of that movement very much.
Wonderful. I'm going to turn it back to Birju for another question.
Thank you, Rahul. I'd love to hear, Fleet, your thoughts on the folks on this call who are inspired by your work but who do not engage with such marginalized populations. Any thoughts on lessons we can take to apply it in our own context, whether that's school or work or home or our place of worship? And even beyond that, if there are ways that we could get involved in the kind of work that you're referencing, I would love any suggestions there.
Well, I think we've known for thousands of years from all the world's great faith traditions, philosophical traditions, indigenous traditions, and especially the contemplative aspects of those traditions, that becoming a more reflective, more awake, more conscious human being is in our own enlightened self-interest. We're going to enjoy our life more. We're going to have better health and better outcomes in life. So it's and now we have the current brain science that supports it. I mean, there's more information coming out every week. And it's so clear now, the evidence that basic, consistent daily mindfulness practice has such salutary impacts on the brain and on life outcomes that if somebody could put it in a pill, they'd be investing billions of dollars in getting it patented right now. So, I mean, you know, the science is there to show how powerful this is. And it's really becoming a no-brainer that human beings from, you know, preschool through the elderly, we should be making available to them basic mindfulness training and basic emotional intelligence training. In other words, we all have this incredibly complex system. The human brain is the most complex organism and machine, actually, in existence, including the whole, you know, the solar system out there. And nobody gave us the instruction manual. But today we kind of have the instruction manual, a combination of the traditional contemplative traditions of modern neuroscience, and we can empower ourselves to begin to self-regulate, even in our own enlightened self-interest. And if we do that, we're going to end up getting much better outcomes for ourselves, and we're going to be much better partners with others in life. So this really applies everywhere, and that's why mindfulness is going into K-12 education, into healthcare, in education, in universities, even into the military, law enforcement, and other areas. So I think it's something whose time has come, and it's becoming very widespread. And again, this idea of, you know, where do I focus my attention? Do I want to focus my attention on you know, my resentful feelings about my circumstances and blaming my circumstances on other people or trying to control other people, which is impossible? Or I do want to, even in my own enlightened self-interest, focus my precious time and energy where I can add the most value, create the most possibility and the most opportunity for myself and others in life. You know, that applies to what we're all doing in life, whether we're working in the corporate sector or the healthcare sector, education, whether we're in retirement, whatever it is, how we work with our kids. You know, one of the ways we get caught down there, what we call below the line and blame, resentment, and so forth, is just being hooked on being right. Well, if we're parents and we have kids, and especially adolescent kids, and we have this deep need to be right and we're getting hooked into being right all the time, we're never going to have a relationship with our kids. They're gone, right? So all of this kind of reflective emotional intelligence training allows us to be in deeper, more authentic relationship with the people in our lives through owning our own stuff, right? Not projecting it onto others. Society of radical responsibility, being accountable, keeping our agreements, being genuine, open, and vulnerable with others. That creates trust and that creates authentic relationship. And that grows across every sphere of human activity because we don't do this thing alone, right? Whatever we're going to accomplish in our lives, we're going to do it in relationship with others. So learning how to be in an authentic relationship with others, to me, is the key human learning. So I think it's there, it's available, and it's applicable to every aspect of our lives and whatever direction our life might take.
Thank you for that response, Lee. As the host of the call, it's my privilege to ask you one final question, which is, how can we as a broader service-based community support your work?
Well, you can learn about it to begin with. You know, our prison work is at prisonmindfulness.org. Also, now a big focus of ours is training mindfulness teachers to work with at-risk populations, vulnerable populations. So that's the same organization, another division, engagemindfulnessinstitute.org. We have a front-to-back initiative to transform the whole criminal justice system at mindfuljustice.org. So, you know, check out those websites, learn about our work. If you want to support our work financially, you can figure out how to do that through the sites. If you want to get involved in it, you can figure out how to do that. We have lots of online trainings where we get people started in how to take mindfulness-based programs into jails and prisons. If you want to become a certified mindfulness teacher, we offer that kind of training. If you just want to be in community with us, we have all kinds of ways to get in community. So, you know, that's where I would start. Just learn about the work we're doing, and if you'd like to engage, find a way to get engaged. We really welcome that on whatever level, in any way, shape, or form that people want to be engaged in this work. And also let us know how we can support you in this work. If you have aspirations to do this kind of work, let us know how we can support you.
Wonderful. We are at the end of our time. And we will definitely send out all the links to your work for the many folks who have dialed in and are listening online. But we'd like to end the calls with a moment of silence where we just try to hold a heart of gratitude in that silence. And at the end of that, we will unmute everyone on the call to be able to just share that gratitude in a collective thank you. So on the count of three, we'll say thank you, Lee. One, two, three.
Thank you, Lee.
Thank you, Lee.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.